David Bohm Seminar, Saturday, March 21st, 1992, 10 o'clock morning session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Well, we had a lively discussion last night, and I don't know if would you like to continue that, to go on with it. I mean, I'd make one remark that we say that thought is fragmented and not basically it always is incoherent, but it can be relatively coherent in a certain area. You can abstract, remember, in a certain area and where the connections can be neglected. Now, the point is not that thought can be ever completely coherent, but rather what is the attitude to incoherence? As if there's incoherence, there may be a tendency in thought to cover it up and to make it look okay, or may acknowledge it and learn, you know, say, try to move to something else. You know, that is a sign that something is not right, you know, that is contradictory. Therefore, that is the key point, the attitude to the perception of incoherence. I think, well, that was all I wanted to add this morning, but I mean, perhaps people would like to go on with what they were discussing.
I was glad you said that about attitude towards incoherence. It relates to something I was thinking about last night, which is, I remember in some previous years you've talked about thought mm-hmm. as being a kind of a form of play. Mm-hmm. And I was noticing last night that in our meeting last night, many of us seem to be taking our thought very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how that balances out against, you know, if there's an attitude towards incoherence, could that attitude contain a sense of playfulness at all?
Yes, I think playfulness means that you're ready to give it up, you know, give up any line or try something different. And so we perhaps should be taking it less grimly seriously.
Just the opposite of what I wanted to say this morning.
What?
Well, I was thinking about our discussion last night and the there was some things said about truth being held as a higher order than self-protection. And then there was some responses that one might not hold the truth that often or that completely or hold the pursuit of truth. And I woke up in the middle of the night thinking of the terrible state that our thinking has produced in this world. All the starving people, all the diseases, we know it all, the stories, we've all heard the story. And that it is going to take an incredibly dedicated energy to penetrate the massive misconceptions we have. And that dedication of energy is what I meant by saying we have to hold the truth or the pursuit of understanding higher than what we're holding now. Because what we're holding now is what's destroying the world. And we are holding it highly. We are holding it constantly. When we wake up in the middle of the night and we think about ourselves as self-protective, worried about our security, worried about our relationships, worried about things that probably are the result and the cause of the problem. And that we have to hold a different thought or a different intention. And it has to be held deeply, at least as deeply as wanting to have a master's degree in something, or a PhD, or be really good at golf. But this thing called truth or pursuit of understanding is held so minimally that whatever information might penetrate our brain once in a while is wiped away by this larger movement of indifference and habitual mindedness. And I'd like to say that as far as I'm concerned, that it's absolutely essential that we who still have a little bit of life left, a little bit of freedom, a little bit of leisure time left to hold this intention, And it has to be held intently. Whether it's there every minute, whether it's operating, doesn't make any difference. What it is that the intention is held. The intentions we hold now are the ones that are destroying the world. Most of the world, as far as I can see, is not in the position to cure the problem anymore. A few of us have the time to come here, the money, the space, to inquire into this. If this is just an inquiry that we're not going to take seriously and deeply and make it root our life, then it's meaningless. Because what our life is really rooted in is the exploitation and destruction of other people on the planet.
Excuse me, might I say something? My sense is that in terms of all the people I've met outside of here, that is why everyone's here. That's my sense of it.
Well, then you're agreeing with them. Good.
Could I ask what we all have in mind when we use the word truth? Because sometimes we talk about having a little bit of truth. Are we talking about seeing facts or seeing a certain level of reality? But there can be a feeling about truth which is something far beyond something partial or fragmented. And I think we should clear up our semantics in this somehow, because it would seem to me that wherever we are is far from what one could call truth, whatever truth is, and that but seeing fact about ourselves or about whatever we're concerned with is something possible when we're not in that state of having dropped all confusion and all egotism and so forth. Can we, I don't know how people feel, but I feel a distinction needs to be made in what we're talking about.
Between what?
Between, in the word truth, mm-hmm. how we are using that word. In other words, we're not using it trivially. The truth is I'm sitting in this chair. Well, there's no importance,
the fact,
and I don't think that's anything to do with I would be think of as truth. It's just a fact. And I think there's a whole progression of things about ourselves that can be considered fact or seen, whatever other word you want to call it. But I'd like to know if you feel that when we talk, so use the word truth, we're meaning it in a very ultimate sense.
Well, not to be contrary, but the truth of sitting in this chair is, I suspect, all the truth that anyone can ever have. And I don't mean that to be contrary.
Well, that's the fact, right? What you're saying is the fact to sit in the chair, that you're sitting or not sitting.
No, the truth of sitting in this chair
is what?
That in the very act, the being of sitting in this chair, contains all the truth that anyone can ever have.
Well, doesn't that thought itself kind of limit you and block you and say, well, there's nothing else? Why do you compose that block from beforehand?
I guess what I'm saying is, if I'm looking for truth somewhere other than where I am, that very movement is the movement that may cut off the possibility of...
Well, the truth is, we don't know anything about it. We have not the vaguest idea of what the truth is. We have a problem even understanding facts.
Yeah. Doesn't truth have to do with understanding rather than just the fact of a person or an animal occupying space? I think it has to do with understanding in that individual.
Yes, well, I mean, we've discussed this before, but you see, we can say a statement or a thought is correct or incorrect. You know, you could say it's correct that I'm sitting in the chair, or it could be incorrect, right? I'm not. No. Yeah.
The saying, I am sitting in this chair, that's just a statement in thinking, which is fine. The truth of sitting in this chair has nothing to do with thinking.
No.
The fact of sitting in the chair.
Not even the existence of being.
The sitting in the chair is prior to any movement.
Of recognition. I think, Enrique, that presupposes that you know what I is, the I that's sitting in this chair. And I think that opens up a whole big thing to look at.
But then you would even ask, am I sitting in this chair? I'm not just being playing with words.
I mean, it can be a statement of fact, as we've said, that's either so, or it can be an illusion that you're sitting in the chair, in which case it wouldn't be correct. But, I mean, to make that, to equate that with truth, I'm uncomfortable about that. I don't feel that we know enough about all the elements of that statement to be able to call it truth.
So if I can suggest, you've made a very challenging statement, and it's very evocative of lots of other thinking, but I would like to maybe offer something to what you said. On the contrary, we have many ideas about truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's bringing out. So if someone might feel uncomfortable or comfortable with a certain idea, the actual truth of truth is still something to be explored into. Mm-hmm. But this is a question that we need to take our time and look into.
Mm-hmm. I feel it would be very dangerous to assume that truth can be defined as an idea. We consider that we're acquainted. It may be the truth is something way beyond the realm of ideas or thought or most of the levels on which we all live. So to say that it's a truth that I'm sitting here, well, it's a fact. But I don't know what truth is, therefore I can't say that it's true.
See, I'm not wanting to persist too much, but the truth of sitting in this chair is not sitting in the chair. I mean, the description sitting in the chair comes after.
Maybe, but is that
that's not held as an idea, or if it is, then it's the same thing, right?
My sense of this, of the way we're using this word truth, is that we're looking at it as kind of a noun or an object. And it seems to me, when I think in terms of truth, it's more an acting or behavior or quality of action that I'm looking for or that I'm interested in, not so much a noun or an idea or object.
Yes, well, I think... we've discussed this before, but the word true means straight, honest, and faithful. You know, that's one of its basic meanings in English, and in Latin, verus means that which is. So, in other words, truth is an act, as you say, which a perception, which is honest and straight, not deceptive. The word false means deceptive, so it would be useful to make a distinction, as I was suggesting, between what statements that are correct or incorrect and truth. That truth is not only the truth of that which is, but also the truth is part of it, because the truth is an act which will clear up what is false, and what is false is actually part of what is, as it's part of the what's going on in the brain. There's a whole fog in the brain, electrochemical fog, and truth, the perception of truth will clear that up, so it makes an actual change. That's what I'm suggesting.
I'm wondering whether I've missed what you're saying, Enrico. Are you meaning the embodiment of truth is sitting in this chair?
Well, all that I'm saying, I think, it's fairly simple, is that there is such a thing as truth, it must be right here. It couldn't be someplace else. And this is called sitting in this chair, so it must be right here. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't talk or inquire at all, but that if I'm looking in my thinking to find something outside of what is going on here, then I will continually miss the possibility.
So what you're saying, what is you're sitting in the chair.
That's a description.
What is.
That's a description.
But see, when David says veritas, that which is, can there be a connection between what David says and what you say? Do you understand it that way?
I don't have any problem with what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I think they're closely related. That which is, as we're saying, is what, you know, what you're that you're sitting in the chair. So you're suggesting that we're going to start with that which is, not something else, right?
Maybe another.
Non-verbally.
What?
Non-verbally.
Yes.
Together with the thinking.
Yes, and the truth makes an act which is non-verbal, which is to clear up what is false. You know, usually that's a key point in the present state of society, that we need to, that what is false conditions us to be false, right? And the truth will clear up that falseness so that the brain doesn't cover up you know, things to make it more comfortable.
Another way of looking at what we're doing here is, rather than an inquiry into truth, an inquiry into the false, or into
yes.
the fog,
mm-hmm.
or
yes.
into, as you put it, the movement away, the looking someplace else. So if we can see and become maybe intimately aware with the subtle nature of that process, maybe truth will take care of itself. It need not be, you know, looked for.
I feel, as Tom does, that that the truth will not clear up what is here, what is wrong, but that one can only come to the truth mm-hmm. when we clear up what is wrong here. Then it is possible for some greater perception. I don't know how you feel
okay.
about that. But
there's something driving us to question all this, right? A lot of people aren't being driven to question this. That seems to me the truth of the matter is driving us. There's something in us that can feel or is generating a kind of movement to question all of this falseness. That I would call the truth. The falseness is what's being examined and questioned and will fall away, and then what was left would probably, what you wouldn't call it anything probably, but that's what I mean when I say that there's something causing, you know, this lady said, hey, from what I understand, there's a lot of us here interested in this question. Right. And the question is being generated, must be by some intelligent movement in the brain, which has some relationship with what I would consider the truth. The truth isn't just...
Let's just, I mean, gently question the assumptions in that, because that has some very potency to it. I feel what you're saying. But when you talk about truth causing something, immediately my mind wonders about truth and this whole relationship between truth and cause and effect.
All right.
So, I mean,
not
that I know
truth
anything.
Is causing. I'm saying the awareness that resides within us somewhere besides this falseness seems to be stimulating this meeting. That awareness has some relationship to the truth. That's all. I think that's all. The
I'd
truth doesn't
hear,
do anything.
I'd love to hear what Dr. Bohm would say about it. This whole,
right.
It seems like it's so much thoughts on thought. And that is just really, you've spoken about that before,
right.
What kinds of thoughts we have that seem to be a little more upstream that drive so many of the problems that we have.
Yeah, I have that same impression. I felt, particularly last night, there were a few people that were really dominating the discussion, and I think that I know several people here, and I know there's some very thoughtful people here who might have a great deal to say. But I think we have to leave openings for those people to say it. And if two or three people dominate the dialogue, then we're not apt to hear anything with truth in it, perhaps, or with understanding in it. I just really feel there has to be left some openings where people feel freedom to speak up, some of those who have not perhaps spoken up yet. And particularly Dr. Bohm.
Right. Oh, well. I'm not speaking as much as I used to. Well, I think that that the very act of beginning to question what is false is the beginning of truth, or the action of truth, right? That I don't think we can make a division, right? That We can't quite say where it comes from, but it starts from the whole rather than from the fragments. And as Joe was saying, that the theories of the brain, which we say that there's the right and the left, which can be very separate and different personalities, and also we have the emotion and the intellect. Some movement must occur which doesn't start from all these parts. And and truth is inseparable from passion, as you're implying. And it will be an act which contributes to what is. It's not only about what is, but it also it is a contributing to what is. That when truth is perceived, then everything, people are different, everything will be different. I mean, it's not really, it looks different, but it is different. But I don't know if we can say a lot more about what truth is.
What about the relationship between thought and truth? And we said thought is always incoherent, but there's an appropriate attitude mm-hmm. towards incoherence. And how does that relate to looking for truth?
Well, the point is that attitude is part of the action of truth, right? The act of the attitude of being open to seeing coherence, because the principal difficulty is the brain seems to be set up to cover up this incoherence and make itself more comfortable, right? And to provide an apparent explanation of anything that causes trouble. Now, therefore, the readiness to look at something which might be unpleasant or difficult is also part of truth. You know, I think, say in Greek, the word is aletheia, which means not being lethargic, being awake. Right? I suppose I don't know what the other words are in other languages. It's interesting. Every language seems to have a different word for it, a different meaning.
Could you say that thought can participate in discovering what is true, or it can be at the service of this movement towards what's comfortable, and then it's distorted, it's contributing to some distortion?
Yes, well, go ahead.
Would that be one way of...
Yeah, well, when thought begins to take over and work on its own, you see, then it's it moves toward what is comfortable. Right, that the reflexes move automatically to what is less troublesome. Now, if thought would be a movement, you know, which is taking place in the context of truth, or the attitude of being open to incoherence, and which is the beginning of it, of that action, I think, then thought will behave differently. You see, it doesn't matter that thought contradicts itself, because if you can see that thought is contradicting itself, then there's no problem. Because then you can go on and learn from that. See, the basic progress, way of progressing with thought, is to actually be aware of these contradictions and difficulties. And these begin to point toward the direction of better, more correct thought, right?
You could say that thought can perceive its own limitations.
Well, yes. We are perceiving that now. We're seeing that, for example, if thought knows that it is an abstraction, then that is a knowledge, at least we know that limitation, right? Inferentially. Now, if thought can perceive that limitation, we have to ask, does thought perceive, right? Well, perhaps so, I don't know. Krishnamurti used to say that the movement of thought has to be aware of itself, which is a somewhat puzzling statement. You know, because other times he's saying, we're saying that thought is mechanical. and doesn't perceive anything. So that suggests that's a kind of contradiction, apparently, and perhaps we focus on that.
Set up now, it seems like thought is pretty well set up not to be aware of itself.
Yes.
But it's actually, I mean, if we can set it up not to be aware of itself, then it might be argued that it could be set up to be aware of itself. Or something could be aware. Right as it stands now, thought just acts and does this thing, and we're doing it. It's sort of an automatic
thing. Thought could be a multivariate phenomenon.
Yeah.
And which means that some parts of thought could be unconscious of itself, other aspects of thought could be conscious of itself, mm-hmm. some parts of thought could be volitional, some non-volitional, etc.
Yes, but you see that this notion that it's the movement of thought that's aware of itself is interesting. You see that the content of thought is not aware of itself.
Operative word seems to be movement.
Yeah, the process, the movement. The.
And you've used this metaphor of the waves on the surface of the ocean, and then underneath the ocean, there's lots of energy in there. Just thought is the surface, on the surface of this.
Well, the content is on the surface anyway.
I'm still not certain how to differentiate between the content of thought and the movement of thought in this way. Mm-hmm. I'm very unclear about how expand.
Yes, well, what is the content of thought, namely the subject, you know, the material you're meaning of the material you're talking about, right? Like the thought about the chair, the thought about anger, and so on. Now, but that thought is created by a movement. Now, even in the case of the computer, we have the content of memory and the movement of memory. Now, it might be fruitful to consider that analogy, that the movement of memory is electric currents flowing through the silicon chips and wires and so on. You see, that movement is modified by the content, right? It's sort of varied, given shape. The content is carried on the movement. So if something is wrong, I suppose eventually we'll have to look at the movement.
By putting content on it.
Well, to see whether that would indicate something wrong. You see, if what you're doing does not produce the intended result, then shows a contradiction. Then you say something is wrong in the computer. Either it's programmed wrongly or the circuits are wrong or something.
Didn't you once also draw an analogy with the movement of music?
Mm-hmm.
That one can look at the content of music as the notes, but the movement of music implies notes, silence, other aspects of the whole of what we know as what comes to us as music.
Yes.
And perhaps there's an analogy with the movement of thought.
Yes, I mean, you would then have to look at thought as a kind of music, which would be difficult.
Can we just introduce into thought the idea of starting to look at it? So.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can conceive of the idea.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's already been introduced. Now I have to give a kind of intention or energy saying, all right, it's a question of how thought looks at itself and whether it can would be revealed by the intention of wanting to find.
Yeah, but you see, looking at itself might mean setting up another part of thought to look, you see, which...
Is the movement another abstraction, or is it something else?
Well, every word we use is an abstraction, but it's pointing to something, right? You see, or it may point to something, right? You see, a sign is an abstraction. The form on the sign is an abstraction, but it may point to something.
So I see, like, generally the brain is concerned, or as human beings, I am concerned with the content of the thought. So now this word, the movement, mm-hmm. is to draw attention to something other than just the content of the thought.
Right.
Is there anything else except the movement? Because the only way we experience thought is in the motion, mm-hmm. movement of thought. At the moment we something comes up in your brain, that's a movement. There may be something in the...
But there seems to be the...
What, but the experience of thought, humanly, can only be a movement. Got it?
But the process of thought seems to create the separation between the experience or the actuality of the thinking process, the movement of thought, and what one thinks about, or what one creates in terms of feelings or physical sensations, you know. I'm angry at you, not I had this thought which then triggered off this anger and the tensions and so on.
But it manifests only in action. Thought manifests only in action.
So it might be as simple as, like Enrico says, sitting in the chair, sitting in the movement of thought, being in touch with this thing which is going on all the time, but yet one is looking at the flickering images on the screen.
Well, that's one of the things we need to be aware of, I think. I mean, that's a fact. that's the way thought works. And it's, if you're going to use thought, it's going to work that way.
Could you make an analogy, as Tom was, I think, just suggesting, with the situation of a motion picture, where you can see the motion picture and be caught up in the storyline, and completely forget that you're watching a movie, you're caught up in the content and the story, which would be like the content of thought. But also you can sit back and kind of distance yourself and realize that it's just images on a screen, and would that correspond more with the process?
Well, that's a kind of analogy, yes, but we can make a number of analogies. You see, there is another case where we are aware of the movement and what is called proprioception, self-perception of the body. You see that generally when we intend to move the hand, you know that the movement of the hand and the intention are connected, that the intention, the movement is resulting from, as part of the, flowing out of the intention. And we can tell the difference from that if somebody moves the hand, right? And where proprioception fails, life becomes almost impossible. If you can't make that distinction, I think Oliver Sacks gave the case of a woman who lost proprioception one night for some reason, and then she couldn't do anything. You can't hold your body up or anything. And she had to learn to replace it by vision. You know, and then she learned somehow to get along. And the... you see, you get into this conflict which we've been talking about. You do something, you don't know that you've done it. See, thought is always doing that. Like the case we know of a woman who had a stroke in the middle of the night or something. She lost her sensory nerves of the hand, of the body or the hand, but still had the motor nerves working. So perhaps she moved her hand against her head, and she didn't know that she had done it. So she thought somebody was doing it. She responded that way. And then the more she fought against it, the more worse it got. So, but when the light was turned on and she woke up, then she could see, right? And stopped this response. Now, so if we can't tell the difference between what has we have initiated as a result of our intention and something else, then we cannot survive. And thought is in that situation, that it initiates a movement. Now, there must be somewhere the intention to think, but we are not aware of it. Sometimes we are aware that we are thinking. We have the intention to think. And we can tell the thoughts are part of the intention, they don't fool us, right? But when they give rise to feelings, then we lose track of that. You see, not only in the head, but also in the solar plexus. It takes several seconds to get down there from the head to the solar plexus. So you may have a disturbing thought, and it has been measured with electrical resistance. See, there occurs a change in the body about 2 seconds later, which shows up on the electrical resistance. So, but that happening 2 seconds later and you don't see the connection, you will take that as another independent feeling. You see, that is the typical thing that goes wrong with the process. You know, that we're not, the movement of thought is not aware of itself, partly because it doesn't realize that the movement of thought is also the feeling and the state of the body and all the results. We have to discuss probably the whole movement of thought.
It seems that we're talking about a different kind of attention. And it seems like we have to go very far downstream following the line of thought to see its limitations. But to the extent that attention lights up the streaming of what sits here, then something else is possible,
besides this following the surface currents of the water, that something that's more self-regulating, self-organizing, self-renewing can take place, that it's of a different kind of attention than that linear movement of thought. And to the extent that we go into something that vivifies that three-dimensional kind of acoustical reality of what's the movement taking place, it seems like it helps to bring coherence. And to the extent to which it takes us into a process of thought, chasing thought, in a sense, I think it distorts or constrains our learning.
Yes. Well, if we to compare this with the music, you see the notes are a way, an abstraction from the content, or you can abstract the content in other ways. And when the notes are being played, then there's a sense of wholeness, of unity, and of movement. The whole system, the whole body is moving in some inwardly. And that gives the meaning of it. Now, but if that doesn't happen, then we'll be looking at some part of it, and then another part will come later, which was apparently unconnected. And then we will be in conflict.
The musical movement is like the coherence.
Right? Hmm. Yeah, or the incoherence. I mean, that is, you could detect disharmony as well as harmony.
Language sets its own set of problems, which are maybe the major problems that we face. Because we all, any piece of music that's played, if it's the most foreign, different culture, we still recognize music as music. But when language gets involved, and we hear someone talking, we're immediately into the content and forgetting that what we're hearing is the movement of thought.
Well, certainly
it's easy
language.
To remember with music. It's very difficult to remember with language. But that's my impression.
Well, now, if you had a person who was very deeply steeped in classical music and somebody gave them some heavy metal music, they might have the same discordance mm-hmm. as somebody who's having trouble with another language. So it has something to do with what you value or the meaning you give certain things. It's very difficult to hear a new kind of music, or for somebody who has a deep relationship with one kind of music to be able to even hear another one and say it's even music.
I'm suggesting something just slightly to the side of that. I agree, but it's the fact that heavy metal would be recognized as a form of music. Maybe the person would think it was pretty.
Perhaps not.
Something that was intended as music. It would have form, it would have system, all the various attributes that one says.
And any language would be recognized as language.
Yeah, but the content would take over the moment.
That's the problem.
And whereas the content of music doesn't necessarily take over from the content or from the movement in one's awareness, when we get to talking, it's what we're talking about that seems to carry the weight.
We spend more time in language than we do in music.
Could I suggest maybe that this is what David was implying, what he was implying before when he said the element of play with regard to being able to take. And perhaps this gentleman over here misunderstood what David was saying with regard to the element of play, that you've got to be not that connected with anything that's taking place.
But we are that connected. That's
well,
the problem.
Well, that's the. But I'm saying, David was suggesting that the element of play is sometimes forgotten as an aspect, a possible aspect, an option available to us when you're watching the movement of thought.
Particularly that, mm-hmm. when you're watching the movement of thought, mm-hmm. can there be a playful attitude towards our thinking and yet perhaps be serious about truth? And maybe those two things are compatible. Maybe it's when you're serious about truth that you're playful about thought.
I'm drowning and you want me to play?
What happens with that when you get to know something without thinking?
What would be an example?
Like being in touch with yourself.
Well, that would be that you are in touch with yourself, then, as you say, then there we wouldn't have this conflict about thought. No, if thought mistaking part of itself for something else.
But we can get to through without thinking then.
What?
We can get in touch with through without thinking.
True. Yes.
I'm curious if when we're speaking about thought and we say, well, we will observe our thinking, and I stop, or I try to observe my thinking, are we talking about the total, kind of the whole response of my body, of my organism, of all of that?
Yes.
Including my perceptions, the things I might think are on the fringe of my perception, that's all my thinking.
Yeah, if you can see the connection between your thinking or your, and all that, see.
So thinking is not simply this verbal thing, but it's mm-hmm. the whole movement of my perceptual... It's all my perception.
Well, the perception is involved in thinking, yes. A perception is affected by thinking, by thought. See, for example, there are many examples of that. If there are far away, somebody shows some letters which are indistinct and he tells you what they are, then you see them. You actually experience it. According to the way you think about it, you actually perceive it. You see, perception, the thought enters into the perception as it does into every other activity. And then may be mistaken for a fact, or, you know, whereas in the thought may be wrong, may be incorrect.
Seems like when we talk about looking at our thought, we have to ask, well, what is the instrument that we'll use to look at our thought? Because if we're going to analyze our thought, then we fragmented ourselves, and there's going to be prejudice and bias and conflict in our observation. So we can't try to look at our thought or analyze our thought as it occurs, and there has to be another instrument, and that's perhaps just being aware of the whole movement of the mind as it's occurring.
Yes, well, the suggestion is that the movement of thought is aware of itself. The movement of thought is a movement of the whole system, including the body. And in the case of the proprioception of the muscles of the arm movement, you don't actually set up an observer to be aware that you are moving, that the hand is moving as a result of your intention. There's no, see, if you say, I'm moving my hand, that's direct. Now, if you let your hand fall, you can directly see the difference.
I think you put your finger on something there that when we look at thought, the tendency is to do it from the point of view of an observer. And that's directly experienceable. You can see that quite clearly that when you look at your thought, that there's maybe some kind of agenda or some kind of judgment or some kind of criticism or some kind of support for what's seen. That there's the thought, which is over there, and there's me, the observer, which is this side of it somewhere. And it seems that you're suggesting that in physical proprioception that there's some kind of intelligent comprehension of what needs to go on.
Mm.
But without an observer.
Yeah.
So the question, one question would seem to be, what are the dynamics, what's going on that makes it so very difficult for us to look at thought without an observer? Because I think that our common experience, and we've talked about a lot of different things in here today, but I think that our common experience is that when we look at thought, we have an observer looking. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why is that so powerful? And what would it take to find out if it's possible to have proprioception there too, as well as in the body? What steps would we take to experiment with this?
Yes, well, that's a difficult question. You see, because the field of perception is so influenced by thought, we find it very hard to distinguish the two, or to know that thought is doing that. I gave the example of, say, listening, watching the television, and if the phone rings, then you may attribute, the brain may attribute the sound to the image, and then you feel it's coming from there. But if it's not consistent or not coherent, nobody gets up to answer it, then you say maybe it's coming from somewhere else. You see, that's the typical sort of way of thought being corrected. And but the thing to notice is the experience is of the telephone is coming, as the sound is coming from that direction. Yeah, it's dealing with the content, but I'm trying to say that the difficulty is really that a lot of what we perceive is still content.
It seems that it possibly one of the problems with thought is that we objectify things. We make something separate from ourselves. We see it as outside, and then we try and deal with it that
yes.
way. Whereas when it's going on inside oneself, you set up a conflict, seeing something separate and then either trying to control it in some way. So we get back into a sort of loop of control. And in a group of people, you can see the play of thought, the display of thought, in a way that it's not quite so easy to see it going on in oneself. That's the value of, we are all connected and we are all together and we see our thoughts displayed in a different way. And we can see how we tend to objectify people, thoughts. Yeah, anyhow, and that,
yeah.
Something is outside.
But yeah, does thought refer to see whether it's correct or not? Isn't that the question?
Well, that's the first point is that thought will discover that things are not working out coherently.
But it always refers to itself the way it's said. Thought is always referring back to itself to decide whether things are correct or not. And that's such a small loop that it's...
Yes, well...
That's analysis.
Yes, but I mean, let's say you're looking at the television and, or you could be looking at an object and saying that it's coming from there. Now you're not conscious of thinking that. See, that's a reflex. And then suddenly you're aware that something isn't wrong.
But then thought refers back to itself to decide what's right and wrong, and that's where the break
yeah.
is.
Well, normally that's what it has to do, I see. I mean, and when thought is actually being applied, right? But now then we're trying to ask something different.
So is there something other that thought can refer to or that can see, if thought keeps referring to itself, it just makes a tighter and tighter insane little circle using its own criterion and its own value system to decide what's right and wrong. And it's just snapping back and forth faster and faster until it... What is this larger thing in the brain or in existence that it can refer to as a... to give it a reflection to see whether it's correct or not? That's what it needs to discover, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that would again make a division, wouldn't it, of something larger in thought.
There was a sense of meaning, I think, that when Lee was talking about the observer and always thought sees itself, or anything else perhaps, with an observer, and there was a sense that, you know, oh, okay, I understand what that means. There's something about that. Mm-hmm. Then the question about, is it possible for there to be observing without the observer or proprioception of thought, that became a meaningful question because the first thing was established as a fact, as something that's, you know, tangible. You know?
All right.
So how to proceed into that observation without the observer is unknown territory, but we're starting with something that we are in touch with, you know. So maybe that's perhaps the clue to become intimately aware with this observer, you know. Mm-hmm. to see the movement in dialogue, perhaps, mm-hmm. because it's much easier there to see your opinions, your prejudices, your background when you're conversing with others. But to see what is going on.
Okay, so what is going on is the thought is constantly referring back to itself as its own value system.
Because there is such a thing as perception.
That's an assumption.
There is such a thing as perception, which doesn't occur within thought. So the thought, if I go to the refrigerator to see if there's milk in there, at some point, if I'm going to find out, perception will have had to have occurred. So that isn't thought just referring to itself.
On that level, we don't have a problem. It's this other level where we seem to be having a problem. And the thought decides its own values in the world and then says the world is that way. So, I mean, in the physical world, if we went that way, we'd already be extinct and the problem would be over. The psychological world is a complete fabrication of our heads. And within that world, we have no reference other than what we fabricate.
Are you asking why that happens?
No, I'm saying we need to find another reference.
Well, can we start with the question of why it happens?
Let's see. Well, you could if you wanted to.
Couldn't we go into the question that was brought up regarding proprioception, because I think he's talking about the division that occurs between the observer and the observed, which is never going to give you a right answer because it's one part of the brain trying to analyze another part of the brain. But proprioception is something different, which I think is quite interesting to most of us here.
Just to maybe add one more thing to what you're asking for, because I think that is an ancient demand. Another reference besides the self. But I think that one has to be gently exploring this, because that urge for another reference may be sought in a subtle way trying to propagate itself. So it may create what it calls another reference, and it may give it some name, call it truth, but it really would be more of the same. So we really are in unknown waters here.
Mm-hmm. I think Anna came up with, I think, an interesting suggestion, if I understood her right just now, and saying, at least what I understood her to be getting at, was the idea that a group of people such as mm-hmm. this and the flow of conversation around strikes me as analogous to the flow, the mm-hmm. internal chat, the stream of consciousness in me, where I'm asking questions, answering them, arguing with myself, whatever. I can hear that all happening here. It's like if this group of us is one person, or we view it analogously as the equivalent of a person, we can watch this stream work. We can see what's actually happening. And it's not a hell of a lot different than what I'd be doing alone, except as you mentioned, it becomes much more clear when it's out there in the open. And there's your point of reference, is we were having thrown out onto a bigger screen where it's tremendously valuable. More and more, as I listen to this and as I think of my own experience, I find that you can't do it all by yourself. You can't play this game out and get anywhere in your own head. It has to be done with others, at least partly, I think.
Whether it's done with others or not, still how attention orients itself seems critical. Because if attention moves in a direction, like thought, so that it's observing something, you know, like movement in which you're watching it either in the mind's eye or out there, or whether there's something awake, attentive in the movement itself, that this orientation, in the sense that the content here can become the context that enlivens our own self-sensing, right? That whether it's something that's said in the room, in the group, or something rising up, the oscillations and how meaning's constelling within our experience, whether we pay attention to it and whether the attention comes directional to it or whether it vivifies three-dimensionally, that movement seems to make a difference.
This movement of dialogue seems to be easier to observe because there's no identification with what's being said by others. Whereas the internal dialogue, there's a definite identification that gets in the way of proprioception. In the room here, you can see much more clearly than you can see internally, but it is the same movement.
I think about the
how bad, considering how valuable it is to be together in this kind of group, of course with the presence of Dr. Bob, that gives us a very deep guidance, even non-verbally. But I can't see my wrinkles if I don't have a mirror. So you help me to see them. And yesterday, so clearly, something which was not correct at all, almost was upsetting, but it was so valuable because you saw it. Could never see it by myself. I could so easily be trapped in the in this vicious cycle of the games of the thought. But that's why I find it's a necessity to be together and expose what is hidden. Of course, sometimes to be skeptical, I may say something that's not correct, but I'll see that. Or I may be dare to speak more, then I'll see and see the dominant thought, or the stupidity of the thought, or the cunningness of the thought, and all the rest of the thought. Otherwise, how can you see without this clear mirror?
Suppose you don't have that. To me, it's a luxury. I'm pleased that I can come here and experience that. Suppose you don't have that. Suppose all you have is you and the world.
Well, I may die in that comfortable deception.
But does that mean is that an inevitability? Is it an either-or situation? Either we can be in dialogue with just this, forgive me, choice little group, or can we do it in reality, on a one-to-one basis with the world, and not necessarily with just ourselves?
This environment is so easy. This environment, in a sense, you know, I hear you saying is a responsive enough environment to help awaken a different kind of attention. You know, in other words, we can extend our capacities for seeing maybe in an environment that's responsive. And I think, in a way, if we look at what we do here as exercising that capacity, then every environment we go into can become just that, and all the content that comes up in experience can become sort of the subject matter in which we exercise that capacity to learn or to sense.
So the attitude then, it may be built it up more clearly, that the watching will start being more clearly outside in our daily life. Because here is built the attitude to be attentive, to watch, to be attentive. So maybe that if it's built within, then we carry it down in our daily life, no matter what we are doing, and maybe that will help to see more clearly what's going to take place.
In addition to the reference points of that are outward, such as dialogue with others, we still have something internally.
Oh, yeah.
You spoke before about just our physical sensations.
Yeah.
There may not be much, but
there's something.
You know physically when you're upset, when you're disturbed, when you're excited, and that surely is a little bit of a
mirror.
Something.
Yes, and you can do it individually or together, or in some other context, that whatever happens, it can be the mirror. And we have to see the connection between what we are thinking or doing and what happens, and how it comes out. Right? See, I think the first thing is to be aware of this contradiction, or this the fact that we get results which we don't intend. Now, if somebody is doing something physically, getting a skill, you see, that when you don't have the skill, let's say to play the piano, you may intend to play, but it doesn't go according to your intention. Now, a person learns then gradually to shape the intention to make it more accurate. And the feedback is always that, or the mirror is always that failure of to agree between the intention and what follows. And now, of course, that requires that we see the connection first of all. Therefore, it seems that, to me anyway, that there must be some awareness or some attention to the intention.
How do you differentiate between those intentions that are, relevant to the whole movement and those that sort of are distorting, in terms of constraining our ability to learn there?
Yes, well, how does somebody who is learning to skill do that, you see? I think it requires some awareness of the connection between the intention and the result, and also a greater awareness somehow of the intention. I don't know that.
Feedback's done, right?
Yeah.
Without the feedback, how can I be aware? And so maybe a mirror is a helpful feedback metaphor in some cases. In other cases, when we're talking about having more proprioception, it's more like a mirror and a biofeedback and a lot of other more three-dimensional reflective or feedback processes with which to tune or extend. If you don't play the piano, if you couldn't hear it, if you couldn't hear the keys except a couple seconds downwind of when you pushed them, it would be a long time when the piano. It's almost as if we have that kind of problem learning to extend on this edge between some internal barometer of whole and truth and this dissipated fragmentation.
Yes. Well, see, generally we're not too aware of our movements, and in order to be aware of them, then I think that what's called for is to be aware of the connection between intention and the result and back. Now, how are we aware of the intention to think, you see? In fact, usually it happens without much intention, without awareness of intention, but there is a kind of unaware intention, which is the result of the reflex. You feel the thing goes. Right?
Like a surge.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that there's all kinds of things in place that allow us to discover whether truth is acting correctly. Or not.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying there's physical things, there's communicative things, there's relationship things, which are not necessarily the construct. But within those, still everything can go wrong. This could be a hate group against a certain, and we could be reinforcing our whole vision of reality, and everybody would be agreeing, and we would feel like we were having a correct perception. So there's still this question of what it is that keeps thought intact in spite of all the feedback, keeps these misthoughts intact. We're living in a world where there's a kind of misthinking going on that's in danger of making us extinct, and yet it seems to be moving moving all the time, and yet all the feedback is from nature and everything else, now a lot of feedback, that it's incorrect thought.
Yes.
Find the place where where is a kind of breakdown between the information coming in and the correct reaction to it.
Oh, breakdown. Well, let's see, just say a word about that. That's what's happening in the ecological problem, that you find more and more articles coming out which say there is no real problem, it's not as serious as you think. It's that tendency of thought to keep on slipping in and saying, making things less unpleasant. Now people, we all get caught in that. Is it possible now to be aware of how that's happening? Now there must be, as you're saying, a very serious intention to truth in some whatever we want to put it. I'll just say that the words which have occurred to me are, say, we have to have attention to intention, and the intention to attend. I don't know if they that would be a sort of a loop. And that intention can sort of slip away.
Would you repeat that again? The in- intention
to attend, and the attention to intention.
That's thought.
What?
The adaptive.
That is thought. Is
what?
The leaving of the attention to intention. That is what thought is. Any thought about thought is.
Yeah, but can there be a deeper intention which doesn't arise in thought?
Yes, as long as you are willing to stop running away from intention, you can then have that. But as long as you keep trying to think about it, you're already ignoring that. You're choosing not to do that inherently. Because thought, looking at itself, is a falsehood. Because you can only look at the past. Mm-hmm. You can't thinking...
Yes, that's the content of thought. Looking at itself is false, but
if thought says I'm looking at thought, it's lying, because it's saying it knows what thought is, but it doesn't.
Yes, so we're saying that it's the movement of thought that has got to be aware of itself.
Right.
With the movement of thought, in a way, is thought. In a way, it's not thought. It's beyond, right? What is the movement of thought?
Thinking.
No, but there's something. To be aware of the movement, it must be beyond thinking.
Wait,
I think there's only thinking.
The movement of thought
thinking.
Implies the body too.
What?
The movement of thought embraces all the instincts of the whole organism, the body, the movement.
Well, I think we ought to break it now. Okay.